This is session 367. I'm Roy Schmidt. I'm going to be moderating this session. And by now, if you've attended Sunstone over the last 3 days, you're pretty familiar with the rules. But just let me remind you, this is going to be a one-hour session. We invite you, if you have a cell phone with you, to either turn it off or turn it down. The session is being recorded, and so if you have questions or comments to make after John is finished with his section, please come up. I'll have a microphone up here that you can use to ask it, so that the question is included in the recording. We still have a little bit of time, and so if you're interested, Benchmark Books has a bookstore next to us, and they've been very, very helpful to Sunstone over the years, and so if you go over and buy a few books, it'll help them out and help Sunstone out also. Let me give you a word or two about this presentation. John writes, "An important part of my faith journey started with my singing in the Tabernacle Choir, continued through my leaving the church after coming out as gay, and ended with rediscovering my Mormon voice through writing. This session will tell the story of how I began the process of mending my divided heart, particularly in the wake of the November 2015 exclusion policy. I will be reading sections from the various personal essays I published since November 5th, 2015. Biographically, John tells us that he is a licensed clinical social worker in Salt Lake City, specializing in trauma, grief loss, faith transitions, and navigating LGBTQ identities. He is singing in his eighth season with the Utah Chamber Artists, including my niece, Julie Hadlock. Again, Julie Clan Hadlock. And his second season with Brevitas, whom I'm not familiar with. So, John, come on up. We want to hear from you.
Hi. I'm going to charge you, if that's okay. Feel free to come over here if you want to. It's going to be an intimate gathering today. Can you guys hear me okay? Okay. I'll give a little introduction, I guess. I'm going to be reading a series of things that I've written, as our moderator said. The night of November 5th, 2015, I wrote a letter to LDS church leadership that was published as an op-ed in the Tribune that weekend. And then in January, after Elder Nelson talked about the policy change and said that it was revelation, after they had prayed in the temple and received it as revelation rather than policy, I wrote, and there was a big upsurgence of grief in the community and a number of suicides reported at that time. I wrote a letter to my 14-year-old self. And then I wrote a letter after the October General Conference in 2016, after Elder Ballard gave his talk asking people who have left the church, where will you go? I wrote another op-ed in the Trib that's around that same time at the anniversary of the policy change, and I wrote another piece on Facebook that I'm going to read about that. And then I wrote a piece most recently in March of this year that is about Well, Elder Lawrence wrote a piece in the Ensign where he talked about LGBTQ identities or families being counterfeit and being wrong, and people created another wave of pain and hurt, and so I wrote a response to that as well. And then I'm going to end with a piece that I wrote out of chronological time. The rest of them are in chronological order, but that is it's called Where Do We Go From Here? So I'm going to begin. I'll be reading for a half hour, and then we'll have time for discussion at the end. So, dear LDS Church leadership, I have something to say. We are not your enemies. Our spouses are not your enemies, and our children are not your enemies. We are your sons and daughters. We have loved this church, been devoted to it, and we honor the rich heritage it brings to our lives and our cultural and spiritual identities. There are real enemies out there: poverty, abuse, famine, war, genocide, human trafficking, climate change, cancer, Alzheimer's, gun violence, addiction, teen suicide, mental illness, homelessness, terrorism, and the list goes on. You are in a unique position of power to affect dramatic, needed change in the world as we face these formidable foes. You have done much already to address a number of these issues through generous humanitarian aid and relief efforts, volunteerism, community organizing, and education. The capacity you possess to create a direct, positive impact in the lives of so many is one of the things I love most about my Mormonism. It makes me feel proud. I'm honored to have come from this tradition. I value my deep and abiding Mormon roots. I see in you a community that abounds with grace and its home-to-home and heart-to-heart expression of true religion. I see that exemplified in my devout LDS mother, my LDS friends, neighbors, and co-workers, and those with whom I was privileged to go on a mission, attend BYU, and sing alongside in the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. Today, I saw something different than that. Today, I saw fear and discrimination as you rolled out decisions and policy that hurt, exclude, and oppress. They don't just hurt me and my fellow LGBTQ Mormons. They hurt the family members and friends of whom I spoke, who love and support me as I am, who embrace and welcome me without conditions or limits, and who extend to me the gifts of love personified by Christ, in whose name they go about their daily work of living and loving as saints in these latter days. What they know, because they have stayed with me even as my path has diverged from orthodoxy, is that I am the same person they have always known and loved, a person they have held in the warm embrace of their fellowship. It is the first call of the gospel to love God and each other with fearlessness, with fierceness, and with fidelity. They see me, and I see them, in all the intricate beauty and wonder embodied within their lives of faith. And so I extend to you an invitation to see us, to know us, to sit across from us and break bread with us, because it is only in so doing that any of us can ever come to understand that those we once viewed as our enemies, as the strange and suspicious other to be feared and kept at bay or constrained and punished, are actually part of the same human family to which all of us belong, as vital and indispensable pieces of a beautiful whole. I learned that from you. It may be the most valuable lesson I carry from my religious upbringing. It is written upon my heart. It's what allows me to write this letter to you now, in sincere love and with considerable emotion, because despite our at times despair-inducing differences, I still see you. Please see me too. Love, John. January 11th, 2016. Dear 14-year-old me, I see you there in the pews, head bowed, lines of tears marking divides down hot, embarrassed cheeks and pooling up in blurry smudges on the pages of the hymnal as you let the sacrament pass you by because you believe you're not worthy. I see you standing alone in front of the basement window in complete darkness and silently mouthing the words, "I'm gay," for the first time, and vowing never to speak those words aloud to anyone. I see you pleading, begging, night after night on callous knees, to have these feelings taken away from you, rooted out of you and destroyed. I see you confessing to the bishop that you touched yourself again and knowing with unquestioning certainty that no one in the world has ever been as base and depraved as you. I see you writing promises in your journal, written with such intense pressure that you can still read the impression of every word for many pages beyond the original entry. Promises to never let Satan get a hold of your heart again, to never abuse your body or mind with impure thoughts, to be the righteous, obedient son God wants you to be from that moment forward, to be perfect, even as he is. I see you looking up ways to die and making plans. I hear you rehearsing to yourself what the note should say, believing the world would be better off without you, trying not to imagine how it would break your mother's heart, and wondering if anyone else would miss you or even care that you were gone. I hear you playing your guitar and singing love songs about girls and wanting to believe you'll feel that way someday. And sometimes, when you're alone in your room and no one is listening, daring to use male pronouns in those love songs, and feeling a wash of profound shame extinguish the fleeting rush of excitement that stirs within you. I see you listening to firesides, reading your scriptures, researching church articles and books that make mention of people like you. I feel your deep despair as you are compared to rapists, pedophiles, and murderers, as you're told that you'll bring about the destruction of society and the end of time's calamities foretold by ancient and modern prophets. I know you fear it's true, that you, in this homosexual state, are irredeemable. But I want you to know something. Something that will be hard for you to believe right now, but I've lived another 24 years beyond your 14, so I'm going to ask you to try to trust me. There will come a day when you will know things that you have no way of accessing now, things that will help you to see the complexity and problems, the complications and wonders of the full history of Mormonism in ways you'd never before imagined. This is important because what was once absolute, black or white, will now become the most compelling variegated gray. And though you don't realize it at the time, this revelatory gray, the miracle of ambiguity in the story of the founding and evolution of our faith, will begin to set you free. There will be a specific moment standing in front of the BYU Museum of Art when you will allow yourself to wonder for the first time if the church was wrong about Emma and Mountain Meadows and polygamy and black people. Maybe, just maybe, they've been wrong about me, too. This thought will fill you up with a bright, burning joy, as real and powerful as any testimony you've ever borne or experience with the divine you've ever had. You will not be in a grove or on your knees. There will be no pillar of light or apparition of holy beings, but it will be an undeniable moment of sacred witness, one you will think back on again and again as you make your own way across the unknown wilderness. And oh, John, you will be kissed in ways that make the hairs on the back of your neck stand up, and time will stop, and you'll finally understand what those sappy guitar love songs were all about. I need you to hold on so you can experience that. And sunset on Charles Bridge in Prague, and dancing till 3 a.m. in London, and crunching your way through piles of fall leaves in Central Park, and driving home after a first date with a boy and knowing you've never been happier. And walking arm in arm with your mom in a gay pride parade. I know, can you believe it? And seeing gay marriage become legal in all 50 states, I swear it's true. And helping people who feel the same way you do now to hold on, to start to believe in themselves and get excited for the first time about what the future holds. And the friends, oh, the friends. All those desperate, lonely nights. You spent praying so earnestly for people to come into your life who would understand you and like what you like and just get you. I need you to know someone was listening. And John, they'll be the best people you've ever met. There will be such love, it will knock the wind out of you. But you have have to promise me you'll stick around first. Though you won't be able to take this in yet, I need you to hear me when I say, you are loved, you are worthy, you are beautiful, you are enough, just as you are. And nothing and no one can ever change that. I can't wait for you to get here. I'm counting on you that you will. I love you, John. October 3rd, 2016. Dear Elder Ballard, today you ask the 15 million members of the LDS Church where we will go and what we will do if we leave the church. I've been trying to answer those questions myself for the past 10 years, so I thought I would respond. It would be easier and more satisfying to simply say it's better on the other side of orthodoxy. But that hasn't always been my experience. The truth is that there is a tremendous amount of loss in leaving. Yes, I've been able to see the world with different eyes. Yes, I'm grateful for the freedom of ideas that has expanded my view on a number of important issues. I wouldn't change that. But before being able to have gratitude for a new perspective, I thought I had to figure out how to deal with the loss. Questions about the origins of the Book of Mormon and the implementation of polygamy and other queries surrounding Joseph's account of the founding of our faith soon led to much larger questions. Is the priesthood real? Is there such a thing as modern-day revelation? Will I see my loved ones again after they die? Does God even exist? Those questions left me with a pit of existential despair unlike anything I'd known. Those questions were all I could think about. I didn't sleep. I didn't eat. I read and read and read. I prayed even though I wasn't sure anyone was listening. It took all I had just to get out of bed every morning, to keep putting one foot in front of the other. I had no idea where to go or who to talk to. I had friends who had left the church who wanted, perhaps needed, me to be happy on the other side of belief. And the people of faith in my life either didn't want to discuss it or admonished me to give up my doubts and come back to what I'd previously known. But I couldn't find a way to unknow what I'd learned about the history of the church, which was miles and miles apart from what I'd been taught in seminary or Sunday school or on my mission or at BYU. What I was going through was not just depression, but grief. Stomach dropping, soul crushing, I don't think I can do this anymore, grief. What I needed was for someone to just be with me in my grief and hold the space open for me to question all I'd known without any part of our relationship being in jeopardy. One of the things Mormons are usually best at is taking care of each other in times of loss. They bring casseroles and tend to the yard and take care of your little ones and remember to check in on you and reassure you that you haven't been forgotten. But the thing that I'd always relied on from my Mormon community was nowhere to be found in the wake of my faith crisis. I was desperately trying to plant my feet as I looked at an oncoming tidal wave of grief, and I was standing to face it alone. Fortunately, I found tree branches to hold onto along the way, keeping my head above water for just long enough to catch my breath before being pulled back under. I know far too many who were swallowed up entirely, whose branches broke, or who couldn't find their own life-saving branches to start with. What if someone had been willing to sit with them and just listen, as many times as it took, until the pain of doubt and betrayal could subside and make way for the beautiful possibilities that rise up from an acceptance of not knowing. The questions, where will you go and what will you do, add shame to grief. They are questions that produce hopelessness and despair. They are questions that lead inexorably to casualties. What if the questions instead were, how can we make room for you here? How can our tent be big enough for those with doubt and disbelief and disagreement and difference to feel included within our broad Mormon family? What if the things we most wanted to know were, how can we welcome you back? How can we keep you safe when the waves come? How can we show you that no matter what, you are loved and wanted here? I believe those are the questions the one whose name this church bears has been asking all along. They are the questions I hope we will start asking each other. What we need in the wake of a tsunami of loss is not a rebuke. What we need is for someone to reach out and extend an olive branch. It may be the only thing that saves us from drowning. Sincerely, John. October 8th, 2016. One may rightfully have expected the hallways of the annual Affirmation Conference, a gathering of current and former LGBTQ Mormons, to be empty this year. Our community has sustained so much loss. I wasn't sure if people would come. I wasn't sure what we would say to each other if they did. After all, what can one say? I got off the long escalator of the Utah Valley Convention Center on Friday night, only to have my fears confirmed. It was as empty as a church house on a Monday morning. I looked into the rooms of stacked chairs and folded tables and thought, oh no, we've let them silence us. Last year we were over 500 strong. Have we really let policy changes exclude us from our own gathering places? And then I heard the faint upswell of a sound I was not expecting, laughter. Laughter echoing through the halls and up the escalator from the floor below where the conference was actually being held. I made my way back down to the ballroom level. When I carefully opened the rear doors, my breath caught in my chest. All I could see was row upon row upon row of my LGBTQ family. And it was then that I remembered something, I'd almost forgotten, what it means, what it has always meant to be a part of this family. Since the first trans woman stood her ground as police shouted for her to get down on the pavement outside Stonewall Inn, since lesbians were the first to take gay men into their homes and stroke their sweat-soaked hair and wash their gaunt, lesioned faces during their early days of the AIDS crisis, when families refused to bury their own sons. To lay claim on being an outsider, on being different, being other, being queer, is also to lay claim on each other, even or especially in the wake of tragedy. I came back on Saturday for the closing night of the conference, which featured a talent show performed by the LGBTQ youth. Close to 70 of them were in attendance, more than double the number from any previous year. Watching them up on stage, being unabashedly who they were. At first, I felt a pang of envy. No opportunity like this had existed for boys like me when I was their age. We learned to hide, or tried our best to anyway. The consequences were unbearable if you didn't. But then I remembered that these kids often face intolerable consequences too. They return to schools, towns, and congregations that still harbor fear around what it means to be different. Bullies now wield the unfettered cruelty afforded by online anonymity, and they are no less treacherous than when they carried baseball bats and tire irons. And yet here were these irrepressible young souls, ages 10 to 17, singing and dancing like there was no more vital place to be in all the world at that moment. And they were right. There wasn't. I didn't understand why, but tears started streaming down my face and I couldn't stop them. All the worry, all the fear, all the sorrow I felt since the November 5th exclusion policy change made its way down my cheeks and pooled in the open hands resting in my lap. And then I felt something surprising, something I hadn't felt in a while. As I kept looking up at these audacious young kids who have lost so many of their own, standing on that stage, smiling and trying their damnedest to harmonize and throwing their arms easily around one another's shoulders, I felt hope. The following weekend, during General Conference, Elder M. Russell Ballard rhetorically asked the members of the LDS Church who are considering leaving, "Where will you go?" In response, my mind returned to the last image I have from the Affirmation Conference. All the kids who'd stood proudly on stage the night before were now linked together on that final Sunday morning, hand in hand as they rode up and down the escalators, time after time to avoid having to say goodbye. One of them called out with rebellious zeal, "I don't ever want to leave." Where will we go? Always back to each other. November 5th, 2016, 1 year after the exclusion policy was first announced. Today, I carry armfuls of lilies. I lay a white lily at the feet of those for whom the church ceased to be a safe harbor and a refuge on this date 1 year ago. I carry lilies for those of us who learned to speak our native tongue of Mormonism before we were taught any other language. I lay a lily at the stone steps of the church I once knew. I mourn what it meant to belong there, to feel welcomed in. I spread rows of lilies along the pews where current members will be seated to worship tomorrow. Lilies for those members who don't believe we are apostates, who would never choose to shut the doors of membership and full participation to our children. Latter-day Saints who wouldn't ever ask those children to disavow us or our relationships. Lilies for all the Mormons who feel both within and without as they line the pews on Sunday. I bring lilies for the ones who sent letters renouncing their membership to a church who would respond with a brief automated reply, declaring them no longer a part of the family they grew up in. How can one express in a letter what it means to offer up your identity because your heart is broken? How can one convey they are leaving because those presiding over this family keep inflicting pain on their LGBTQ brothers and sisters? How can one say that while a part of them wants to stay and advocate for change from within, another part of them knows they will die if they do? Instead, hollow formalities are drawn up on both ends about one's name being taken off a list. How do you let them know this list also includes the names of the people you've loved over a lifetime? I lay a lily at the headstones of those. Who are no longer with us. Sometimes I want to shout their names. Sometimes I want to say each name in hushed reverence. I can't speak their names without tears choking my words. Sometimes I'm afraid the crying won't stop. I need people to know their names. I want to yell out loud, loud enough that everyone can hear, "He was only 17. She was 21. He was 15. But how can you say all the things that ache in your heart and burn in your lungs when you're afraid the ones who most need to hear have stopped listening? I place a lily in the hands of the parents, siblings, and loved ones who wonder every day who those children would have become if they'd stayed. I hold a lily against my own chest, a chest that heaved with sobs 1 year ago tonight when the November 5th policy came to light. I step outside with the last lily and bury my hands up to my wrists in the surprise of warm November earth. I move fistfuls of soil with sure, deliberate fingers. I place the last lily, bulb still attached, into a hole containing my grief and my hope. The last lily is for all of us. The image in my mind as I plant it is of the many young faces I saw dancing during the closing night of the Affirmation Conference. I picture their sweat-soaked hair bouncing wildly, their eyes filled with what can only be described as joy. As I close my own eyes, after pulling the warm earth close around the roots of the last lily, I pray it will grow into some semblance of the astonishing beauty I witnessed in those sweaty, smiling teenage faces at the affirmation dance. And I pray that someday everyone will be able to see in those faces what was unmistakable to the rest of us who were gathered around the edges of that hallowed dance floor, that they were perfect. Exactly as they were. March March 20th, 2017. When I was a student at BYU, I would make my way up Temple Hill Drive every week. I would find a spot with the most clear view of the brightly illuminated Provo Temple and sit in silence for hours at a time, silence interrupted only by the sound of my tears. I imagined I would never be able to attain the peace and happiness promised inside the walls of that temple. On the worst days, I would drive back to my apartment and sit on my bed in total darkness, trying to find reasons not to take my life. I purchased a box cutting razor at the BYU bookstore and carried it in the front pocket of my backpack. On good days, I thought about throwing it away. It was inside a small, sterile office in the BYU Counseling Center that I first said aloud the words, "I'm attracted to men." I was 25. After many months, I finally told my therapist about the box cutter in my backpack. He asked me to take it out and hand it to him. I hesitated. "John," he said, "there are people who would miss you if you weren't here." He asked me to verbalize a list of those who would be impacted by my absence. I started crying when I struggled to come up with more than a handful of names. He paused, and with uncharacteristic emotion in his voice, he said, "I want you to add my name to the list." I cried harder and handed him the razor. I hadn't met any openly gay Mormons at that point, so the only tool I had to break up the dark thoughts that plagued me each night was a brittle sense of a worth I possessed beyond my sexuality. But then I would be reminded again every day of the reality of my unmet longing to be with a man. My therapist had been recommending that I attend the local Evergreen support group for same-sex attracted LDS men. They met in the conference room on the top floor of a nearby hospital. I made the long journey up those stairs and stood in the hallway outside the conference room for several weeks before I found the courage to finally open the door and step inside. What surprised me most was how normal everyone was. I had built up all these nefarious ideas in my mind about what it meant to be gay. What I found instead were men who, like me, seemed mostly scared and awkward, humble and sincere, funny and kind. I found friends. And in those friendships, I started to find myself. My self-regard became less brittle, my hope less fragile. "These men are gay," I thought, "and they are also, despite their quirks, lovable. So maybe I could be lovable too." This thought was a revelation. Some of those men stayed active in the church, caught between spiritual devotion and sexual identity. "I no longer believe you have to choose." More of us eventually found our way outside the parameters set for us by our Mormon faith. Too many didn't make it. I think about them all the time. I wish they could have lived to experience what I see happening within the hearts of so many Mormons. What I see, what I feel from within those Latter-day Saints is a desire to understand and an impulse to love. Of course, that isn't true of all, but it's a big church, and there are far more who have reached out to welcome me in than there are those who have made it a point to shut me out. Far, far more. The reality of their love is the second thing that came to mind when I read Elder Lawrence's words calling our families counterfeit and worthless and a twisted version of something good. The first thing that came to mind was anger. But the second thing, an image of the love and understanding I've received from Mormons of all stripes, is what has stayed with me. Elder Lawrence is wrong, as was Elder Bednar, when he expressed similar sentiments at an international symposium on traditional marriage. There was a time when their words would have evoked unbearable sorrow in me. I still ache for the young people who will hear and take to heart their words. I worry about the grave impact those words can have on them. But as I said, my hope is stronger now. The beating heart of a church, like any organization, is the people in it, not the men currently in charge of running it. I don't believe the men in charge have insidious intentions, but I do believe they are wrong, just like many of their predecessors have been. That doesn't make the church untrue. It makes the church a growing, evolving, complicated organization with 15 million members worldwide. And it is in the hearts of those members. Among them, my 77-year-old mother. That I still find my sanctuary. There aren't many things I believe with absolute certainty anymore. But one thing I know is that myriad church members' hearts were just as pained by Elder Bednar's words and Elder Lawrence's words as mine was. I know many church members' first thoughts upon hearing those words were of me and of my friends. I know their first instinct was to reach out, to assure us that as long as they have a home, we will have a place in it. That whenever and wherever their table is spread, we will have a seat around it. And that whenever we decide to celebrate our love with the person we've chosen to make a life with, they will be there in the front row, applauding louder and weeping more tears of joy than anyone. This is my testimony of Mormonism. It burns as bright as it ever has. It runs deep in my bones. And nothing anyone says could ever change that. So where do we go from here? We keep speaking up, even when the powers that be aren't listening, because we can listen to each other. We can hear one another's stories. We can gather and invite and welcome and include. We can turn down the vitriol and turn up to full volume the actual meaning of love. We can publicly denounce discrimination and exclusion. We can claim each other. And go on claiming each other time and again, no matter what happens. For we are all part of the same body of Christ. In the words of Ruth, "Whither thou goest, I will go, and where thou lodgest, I will lodge. Thy people shall be my people, and thy God, my God." Zion is in the hearts of the people, and so, when all is said and done, is the real source of power. Change in any organization always starts from within. So you keep seeing me, and I keep seeing you, outside of labels and handbooks and policies and press releases. The thing Mormons have always been best at is building and sustaining community. It's circling the wagons, not against some perceived outside threat, but around our most vulnerable. You are my people. And those in charge may continue to call me an apostate, but I will keep calling you and them my brothers, my sisters, my family. What I know is that you possess enough love to move proverbial mountains, the pioneer blood that moved our people across plains through cold and hunger and disease and fear of the unknown still courses through our veins and makes us who we are, a people who are proud to say we're Mormon. Because that has, from its inception, meant belonging to each other as much as to God. So we take all our outrage and our protest and our disagreement, and we direct it toward loving the hell out of the queer kids sitting in the pews and their parents and their leaders. We let them all know what we believe about the radical inclusivity of love. We let them know that we are a safe place, that we see and honor and affirm them as they are, that our table is big enough for everyone to have a seat there, because that's our religion, and no one else gets to define that for us. Thanks.
I'm going to open this up for questions or comments in just a second, but I'd like to make a statement. And I hope that I'm not abusing my my position as moderator. I met John on Thursday. I was down at the Community of Christ booth, and he came up and just introduced himself. And I'd never seen him before. I am so blessed by having been moderator of this session. You have blessed my life. Like you, I'm former LDS. And I remember on the Sunday after the announcement was made, having people come to our little congregation because their hearts were broken and they didn't know where to go. And they felt they needed a place of peace. John, I barely know you, but I love you with all my heart, and you are perfect in my eyes, and I know in the eyes of God. Thank you for blessing my life. Now, questions, comments? Come on up. Use the mic so it's included within the recording of this session.
John, first of all, thank you. That's beautiful. Just so much part of you. Question, you wrote some of these letters to some general authorities. Any response, if any, and what they said? No? Okay. All right, done.
No. The end.
Other comments, questions? Come on up. This gentleman, and then you.
That was beautiful. Thank you for sharing your story. I'm interested to know kind of what your current relationship with the church is, like what level of engagement you have and how that's working for you, and is that something you could speak to?
I imagine, like lots of people who go to Sunstone, I go to funerals and baby blessings and occasionally baptisms. But more than that, I think what feels like a more true answer to me as far as how I stay connected to the church or what my current relationship with the church is that I have stayed very involved in the lives of people I love who are active LDS and stayed very connected to them. I'm very curious about their lives, their wards, their callings, their children, their children's struggles with their own faith, like their heartache over that. Like I've tried to leave open space that gives preeminent value to how important that is to them, and to show up at those events that I named, but also at concerts and at Sunstone, even though to Orthodox Mormons that feels like showing up on the fringes. To me, it feels very Mormon. Yeah, I mean, I think that it's been important to me to go to my BYU Singers reunions and my mission reunions and to go to the Motab Christmas concerts and to go to all the things where it would be easy to stay away because those things can be painful. I keep showing up. And in my way, that feels like how I am involved in Mormonism, and I write about it when so moved upon to do so. So.
John, I'm curious, it's kind of a similar question. You have been so vocal with your writing about your feelings with the church, and he asked you what your involvement is. I'm curious what your line is or what your boundaries are, because some people that I know are gay and fully active. Most have left and have distanced themselves from any kind of activity. And I'm curious if you could articulate what you think a healthy boundary is in terms of activity as a gay man or a gay woman with a community that is where the LDS Church is right now.
Sure. I mean, I think the answer to that question is, you know that I'm going to say this, is very individual. I think for every gay man, every LGBTQ person, every woman, every person of color, every person of different ability, a person who's been divorced, anybody who feels excluded within the framework of the church, like they have to decide what those boundaries are for them. That has changed for me over time. As you know, you've been with me on that journey. When I had to leave BYU and the Tabernacle Choir, because I acknowledged my bishop that I was gay, and he was not kind about it, and wouldn't give me an ecclesiastical endorsement, so I had to leave and transfer to the U. I was hurt and I was angry, and for the first years after I moved to Salt Lake City, like I didn't do those things as much as I do now, and I think that's okay to give yourself space and room to not show up to reunions or Sunstone or step foot on Temple Square or BYU campus. Like I had years, several years, I don't know how many, probably 4 or 5, where that was more the case. And luckily I wasn't writing as much or as publicly then. If I had, it would have sounded a lot more angry and had a lot more expletives, which is okay too. That's part of our process, right? Being hurt, being angry, needing to take a step back. I didn't expect that I would be here, but I think sometimes, like, I have wanted to claim, as I've said several times in my writing, I keep pointing to my phantom folder. As Joanna Brooks has said, like, the way that we claim each other on the borderlands, that other, like, people so often ask me, especially as I've been absurdly advertising this session in ridiculous ways this week, which has generated interest. Sorry that David Archuleta is not here, nor is Justin Bieber or Christina Aguilera. I made ridiculous Facebook posts saying that they were going to come because I knew everybody would be at Carolyn and Julie's. People have asked, several people send me messages and say, like, why are you publishing about Mormonism all the time? Why are you talking about this? Why is this still in your life? Including people who are very active and feel like I don't get to claim that, and people who are on the outside and feel like it's damaging or harmful for me to still be involved. And all I can tell them is that in a real way, like I said, and my last thing is that these are my people and I believe that. And It feels empowering to me. It feels like a reclamation to me to still be able to call myself Mormon and not have to say ex-Mormon, former Mormon, inactive Mormon, though all those things are true. Like, but to just say Mormon, the way that if any religion exists long enough, people can say about being Jewish or Catholic or whatever, because I am, and that's how I was born, and you can't erase my history or my tribe.
John, how's it going?
David. I know everybody's name, so I can just say your names.
Oh, yes. I'm wondering how the process of the writing itself and potentially responses thereto have played a part in that last year and a half, so 2 years of your journey, perhaps mentally and then socially, any way that you want to respond to that.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I think that I was surprised at the traction a lot of those pieces have had. All of those pieces that I read have had a big response on social media. Almost all of them have been published. And so, especially after my letter to church leadership and to my 14-year-old self, I got many, many messages from parents, from vulnerable kids, who said, thank you so much. Like, I read your letter to my family. This is the first way I knew how to communicate to them what this was like. From teenage kids who said, like, I was feeling such despair, I read this, and this helped me to know that somebody has felt what I felt and that I can hold on to. I feel like that is priceless, and so whatever hate mail that I've gotten or pushback, which I get, for sure, that makes it infinitely more worth it, and that has encouraged me to keep doing that because I feel like that's my audience. I try to write in a way that can be palatable to people who are active believing Mormons, but my real audience is the parents of the kids who are vulnerable. The parents of the feminist kid, of the kid who isn't sure of their queer identity, of the kids of color who feel like they don't have a place in a predominantly white church. Like, I feel like if you can speak from the margins and feel like you have a voice that reaches an audience, like, that is empowering for the kids, for their parents, like, that's who I care about. That's who I'm trying to write to, and I feel very motivated to do that. I don't ever expect to hear from LDS Church leadership. We have some more time, but I'm not sure if people want to speak.
I too am John Bonner, and I just wanted to say that I understand better your feelings about the policy change regarding gay families that came out a couple of years ago, and I do understand better now how you feel about that.
Thanks, Dad. It's my dad. Hence the same name. This is my sister.
So, this is one of the most Christ-like people I've ever met. Non-judgmental. So, wherever you go, when you die, I hope I can rise up to the same level, because I'm sure it will be paradise. I'm very proud of you.
Thanks, Melanie. I also say the F word very prolifically and make a mean cocktail, so let's take that down a few notches off the idealization. But thank you, I love you too. And my mom. This is somehow Sunstone testimony meeting. That's what happens when Carolyn and Julie de Azevedo are speaking at your same session. You get,
well, I just want to say that John's a really special person. And we have a wonderful relationship, and I'm grateful. And you're very lucky to have him as a friend. I've never known anybody better. I love you, John.
I love you too, Mom.
John, you've talked a lot about the role that writing has had in your life, and I'm just curious to know a little bit about the background of when you discovered and how writing became a part of your life. Mm. I'd be interested to hear what you have to say about that.
Mm. The first thing I wanted to be when I was five was a writer. I wanted to write children's novels. And then I wanted to be a child psychologist. And I think both because I wanted somebody who could give voice or allow me to have voice for the things that I didn't have access to in Rexburg, Idaho. Because I think that's the most powerful part of writing. C.S. Lewis said we read to know that we're not alone, which I think is true. So I wanted somebody who was going to say things that would speak to me, and I thought maybe I could say something that other people would connect to. I wrote a lot at BYU. I had I was an English major with an emphasis in creative writing, so I was writing a lot then. Mostly young adult fiction and poetry, but when I came out, I stopped writing. I moved to Salt Lake, and I think that I lost a big part of my identity. Like I said, I was angry. I didn't know exactly what to say or how to find my voice, and I don't think I knew how to take ownership of having a queer voice and having that feel legitimate and honorable, because I had internalized deep, deep, deep shame messages. So to reclaim my voice as a gay person has felt really beautiful and empowering to me and important to me. I think that was something that I pretty scrupulously try to avoid before in my writing, but they say to write what you know. So I think I hope my writing is better now too, because I think that's the only powerful writing is the one that finds the vulnerable truth that all of us can somehow find ourselves in.
Maybe one or two more questions or comments. I don't think I can reach quite that far.
Hey, Craig.
I think a lot of gay people struggle with self-love or feeling good and respecting themselves, and we're kind of working hard to please other people. You know, you talked about writing in a palatable way. I'm just wondering how you feel about overcoming that, because it's something I'm still working on.
Me too.
Do you feel like we make progress on that, or we're kind of doomed, and people think we're great, but sometimes we don't think we're great, and I just kind of wonder how you work on that, because I'm trying to do that myself.
Yeah, no, that's a good question. For sure, still a work in progress for me. I mean, I think it, like when I repeated shame 4 times of how that's been internalized, that's very true. I mean, like most of us, I have an inner critic who is an asshole and is relentless, and that's hard for me, but that is true. I spent a lot of years in therapy and have learned how to embrace that. I think I wanted to kill that off for a long time, that voice that was telling me that I wasn't good enough, that I wasn't worthy, and it would get bigger, I think, the more that I was trying to extinguish it. And so learning to, this will sound a little woo-woo maybe, but learning that part within me that is deeply hurt and wounded actually wants to be embraced and needs to hear that he is loved instead of being extinguished is powerful. So to allow room for that voice, which I think is an old and primitive voice that comes from when I was a young child saying that I wasn't good enough, like finding a way to know that voice is part of me and it's trying to reach out to have love and acceptance rather than needing to be excised, is powerful to me. So that doesn't mean that it has gone away. It doesn't mean that I don't still have those thoughts and feelings all the time. But it means that I have, in an odd way, made friends with those feelings, because that's part of me too. Just like my depression and my anxiety. Like I don't do better trying to like ward off and fend against those things. They're part of who I am, and they make me a better writer and therapist and human. So that's true. Becky.
I appreciated that question. It was really related to what I was pondering as well. I sort of related hopelessness for those who are going through very dark periods of hopelessness. What do you recommend? What has brought you hope in particular? I know you've mentioned a few things already, but what do you recommend for those who are going through, for whatever reason, whether it is their orientation or whatever, periods of darkness that way?
That is a great question. Honestly, part of why I wanted to do this, I mean, my friend Dori Jo had encouraged me to, who's speaking right now, so I'm sadly not at her session, but is because the main thing that has given me hope, actually, is finding a voice, which is why I titled this presentation Voice Lessons. The thing that can most readily pull me out of the place of despair and anguish and self-criticism is when I am exercising the things that I think make me uniquely me. And so when I am singing and when I am speaking and when I am writing and when I am doing therapy, like those are the times that I actually feel the most hopeful, because I feel like despite all of the despair and the crashing loneliness that can come in on all of us, I feel like that's a reason to stick around, to have something that you feel uniquely passionate about, purposeful with, that you're good at, that you're supposed to be here for, because it makes a fucking difference in the world. I feel like I found those things, and I feel like those things are not attached to my religion, to my weight, to my relationship status, to the other things that have said that I am not good enough, because those things are the things that are the most true and important about me, and I'm going to keep doing those things for as long as I can.
One more? Once again, John, thank you so much. And would you mind standing and giving John?
Thank you. A compulsory standing ovation. I'll take it. Thank you. Thanks for being here.